John moved his right hand. It hurt badly from the burns he sustained from the live steam. He thrust it back into a side pocket of his parka, and he was cold, colder than he could ever remember. Rourke burned his way through the gunner's dome of a Soviet missile launching platform. The flames nearly devoured him. The flames burned away large portions of his Arctic gear, despite the clothing's fire-retardant protection. But the drifts he plunged into as he cleared the huge machine before it rolled over the edge of the Great Plateau extinguished the flames. The out-of-control missile platform rolled and tumbled, destroying itself as it plummeted through the abyss. Rourke burrowed into the snow to save himself from incineration, obtaining what protection he could as the other enemy machines around him exploded, targeted by the missiles from the mobile launcher he escaped. As the snow melted into icy water, it drenched the linings of his parka and snow pants, saturating his Arctic gear, the sweater, and battle dress utilities beneath. He was soaked and shivered almost uncontrollably. Each passing second chilled the dampness into ice. His body temperature kept dropping. Rourke's medical training and his common sense told him he must find shelter, must strip off his freezing garments before hypothermia set in hard enough to kill. Rourke reached for the energy weapon, but Paul already held it.
Come on!
Rourke oriented himself, then broke into a jog trot toward the German armored vehicle he dubbed Atsak. The massive machine sat barely visible against the snowfield as an odd-shaped mound. The synth fuel fires burned dangerously close to it. Paul and Michael fell into a jog through the snow on either side of John.
Michael! Did you turn the systems back on?
If not, the Atsak would only be a windbreak, but otherwise nearly as cold as the natural environment surrounding them.
Everything's up and ready! And with enough speed up, we can roll through those fires without burning the treads!
The double exertion of running and shivering was beginning to tax Rourke's strength, already depleted as a result of the battle to take control of the Soviet missile platform and capture the energy weapon. As they neared the mounded snow, the outline of the Atsak took on greater definition. The full-tread, all-terrain vehicle was smaller than a single-story house, the wedge-shaped titanium plow taller than any man, reminiscent of the cowcatchers on the 19th-century steam locomotives that once plied the western frontier. Rourke pulled his right hand from his pocket, using it more for balance than for anything else. Most of his right glove burned away in any event. To touch the bare metal of the vehicle would cost him more skin. He climbed up the tread and toward the portside ladder, shuffling snow from the rungs as he moved, and gingerly sliding his flame-burned left hand along the vertical stanchion. He reached the height of the Atsak superstructure, tugged at the hatch, and threw it back. Desperation and exhaustion drove him, powered him. Paul and Michael, navigating the Soviet energy weapon between them as they climbed, were just below him, mounting the superstructure. The energy weapon was about the size of a pre-war M60 machine gun, and about the same weight. Paul had it now as Rourke started down through the hatchway into the environmentally sealed antechamber. Michael slid down the ladder's verticals, jumping to the floor just behind Rourke. Paul passed down the energy weapon to Michael, then followed down the ladder. As Paul passed beyond the hatch, he slung it back. Rourke hit the powered locking unit controls and the hatch sealed. Then John activated the air scrubbers. Air, it seemed cold despite its warmth, flooded the compartment. Rourke swallowed to equalize the mounting pressure in his ears. Finally, the green light flashed on. Rourke activated the interior hatch controls. John Rourke moved down and through, the comparative warmth suffocating to him. He dropped the rest of the way down the ladder and into the Atsak's ready room.